Thank you for letting me come and speak to you today. Let me first of all say something that you expect denominational employees to say, and that is to say thank you for your giving to the cooperative program. But let me say this from my heart. I have the benefit of working with our 4,800 missionaries around the world in my IMB role, with our 3,200 students at Southeastern, and then my IMB role connects me with all of our seminaries. So I get to see what's happening around the world and around North America in a blessed way. I just love seeing what God's doing, and I get to see every day what God's doing because Southern Baptists give cooperatively. While I recognize we all wonder where this will land 10 years from now and what this will look like 10 years from now, I want you to know that when we do our work together and you give your dollars week after week after week, and it may seem like a few dollars that go into the pool, when God puts the pool together, God's using this to touch the nations. I'm telling you, I've seen God do great things on our seminary campuses and through our missionaries, through our church planters, through the North American Mission Board that, frankly, we couldn't do were it not for Southern Baptist giving every week. And so I believe in this because I've seen what God's doing through it. So when I say thank you, I mean that from the bottom of my heart, because I couldn't do what I do were it not for Southern Baptist giving. So I'm a product of Southern Baptist giving. My first church, I started pastoring in 1981. I was 20 years old, had no clue what I was doing other than I was supposed to preach the word. I got my first paycheck. It was $45. And it was a combined paycheck from then the Home Mission Board, our local association, my church, and our state convention. And so the four groups gathered together to pay me a little bit. But I couldn't even start it were it not for Southern Baptist giving as they did. And from that day on, that's been a long time ago, Southern Baptists have made it possible for me to do what I do. And so I mean it when I say thank you very much for your giving. All right, let's go to the Bible. Let's get at the Gospel of Mark. My job is to talk about evangelism and missions, and there's much we could do. We could talk about programs, we could talk about ideas, we could talk about what's happening around the world. And I'm happy to do that, but I want to go back to what I think is a more central issue as we think about reaching the nations, as we think about reaching our neighbors. And that comes back to what do we really think about Jesus? What do we really think about Jesus? I want to walk through a little bit of the Gospel of Mark, and I'm going to put a formula on the board, unpack that a little bit, and hopefully give you something to think about as we have lunch together and as you go back to your ministry location today. Go with me to Mark chapter 1, verse 1. The book begins with what may well be a title, The Beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ. And then read the next words to me if you've got your copy there. What's it say? Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So immediately, this book just embarks on this is who Jesus is. It's the fastest moving of the Gospels. By chapter 3, we're halfway into Jesus' ministry. And we just, you just start and you just keep going in this gospel. There's almost a sense of you have to once in a while take a breath as you read through the Gospel of Mark. And so we're immediately hit with, this is the beginning of good news about Jesus. And he's not just anybody. He's not just anybody. He is the Son of God. And then we go into the story of John the Baptist. Look with me at verse 2. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way, the voice of one crying in the wilderness. Prepare the way of the Lord, make his path straight. John appeared, baptizing in the wilderness and proclaiming a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sins. And all the country of Judea and all Jerusalem were going out to him and were being baptized by him in the river Jordan, confessing their sins. Now John was clothed with camel's hair and wore a leather belt around his waist and ate locust and wild honey. And he preached, saying, After me comes he who is mightier than I, the strap of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop down and untie. I have baptized you with water, but he will baptize you with the Holy Spirit. Now, pause there for a minute and think about John the Baptist. And consider this possible. Do you think John the Baptist might have struggled with the temptation to be arrogant? Might he have had cause to struggle a little bit with pride? What comes to mind? Why might he have wrestled some? Talk to me a little bit. Why might he have wrestled with? All right, first of all, the text says all Jerusalem, all Judea coming out to hear him. Certainly hyperbole a little bit, but to show the picture that all kinds of people, large crowds are coming out to hear him. And he's not the street preacher. They're not just walking past him. They're coming to him to hear him. What else do we know about him that might have caused him to struggle with at least the temptation of arrogance? Yeah, his birth is announced by an angel, for goodness sake. Now, I don't know how much he knew about it, but I can imagine him in fourth grade nudging his classmate, "Tell me about your birth." How many people have their birth announced by an angel? He's the first prophet in centuries to come. He too is a prophesied one that would come to be the forerunner of the Messiah. All kinds of people are going out to hear him, and are they listening to him? Many are. They're being baptized for the repentance of sins. And so he could, if he filled out an annual church profile, he could say, "They're coming, here are the crowds, and here are the people getting baptized." I would think it would be really tempting to think, "All right, I'm significant in the kingdom." Would you wrestle with that, perhaps? Well, then you keep reading. Look at verse 9. "In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John of the Jordan." Would that not build you up a little bit? Again, on your annual church profile, would you not be tempted to say, "All right, we baptized this many people, and one of those was Jesus"? I would think it has to be a fine line. This is part of the struggle I think all of us face. There's a very fine line between saying, "God, please use me for your glory," and crossing that line to say, "And make sure Baptist Press knows about it." And I think that struggle is real. I don't want my students, for example, I don't want our missionaries backing up and saying, "Now, God, don't use me in any significant way because I might struggle with arrogance." I don't want them going there. I don't want them going this side of the line and saying, "God, use me in such a way that everybody knows about who I am." I don't want them going there either. I want them saying, "God, use me in a powerful way, so powerful that people are amazed by what you're doing." I want them there. But there's that fine line you have to walk. "God, use me in a mighty way, but don't let me worry about Baptist Press." And I could see John wrestling with that, but here's what he says. "After me comes he who is mightier than I, the strap of whose sandals I am not worthy to stoop down and untie." And he sets the picture for us that the rest of this book is about pointing to Jesus. It's about pointing away from ourselves, deflecting the glory that we might see who Jesus is. And we pick up then, go with me to verse 10. "And when he came up out of the water, immediately he saw the heavens opening and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And verse 11 says, and a voice came from heaven, 'You are my beloved Son. With you I am well pleased.'" So here's the second time in the first 11 verses of Mark's gospel we learn that Jesus is not just anybody. Who is he? He is the Son of God. And who says it this time? It is the Father. "Father, you are my beloved Son. With you I am well pleased." And now we've had the narrator say that this is Jesus, the Son of God. This book is about the good news of Jesus. Now we have the Father saying that. Jesus embarks upon his ministry. He calls out these disciples. Now go with me to verse 21. "And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were," and this is what I want you to see, this next word, "they were astonished at his teaching. For he taught them as one who had authority and not as the scribes." This word astonished or amazed, very amazed. The wording is different throughout this gospel, but this word echoes throughout the gospel. Here's what happens. Jesus shows up. He teaches. He heals sometimes. People are amazed. He teaches like nobody else. He has power like nobody else. They're amazed. And you know what they do? They go talk about him. They go tell others about him. It doesn't mean everybody's amazed. There are some people who see Jesus do stuff and they say he's doing it by the power of the devil. So not everybody believes. But what we often see is Jesus works, he teaches, the people are filled with wonder, and they talk about him. Keep reading, verse 23. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. And he cried out, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." So who is it this time that tells us who Jesus is? The demon. It's the demon. In fact, there are a couple of places in Mark's gospel where the demons are saying, this is who Jesus is. He's the Son of God. He's the Holy One of God. And Jesus tends to just shut them down because it's not his plan that the demons proclaim who he is. It's his plan that we do the proclaiming. But it is striking to me here, and you see this in all the gospels. Watch when Jesus encounters demons and see who speaks first. It's almost always the demon who says something like this, "What are you going to do to us?" Or, "Don't throw us into the abyss," because they know when Jesus shows up, they're done for. They know they've met their match. But it is striking to me here in this gospel, the demons understand better who Jesus is than the religious leaders do. They know he's the Holy One of God. The leaders will say he's a blasphemer. Jesus rebuked him, this is verse 25, saying, "Be silent, come out of him." And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all what? What does verse 27 say? They were all amazed. So they questioned among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him." And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. Jesus shows up, he teaches, he works. He's amazing. People go tell. It's just the way it works. Now he heals Simon Peter's mother-in-law. Continue reading. Continue looking at this chapter. And go with me to verse 40. The crowds are gathering. People are hearing about Jesus. Jesus gets alone with the Father to pray, and Simon and others come and find him. And then verse 40 says, "And a leper came to him, imploring him, and kneeling said to him, 'If you will, you can make me clean.' And moved with pity, he stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, 'I will, be clean.' And immediately the leprosy left him, and he was made clean. And Jesus sternly charged him and sent him away at once, and said to him, 'See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded for a proof to them.'" So he tells this cleansed leper, don't go speak of this yet. Go follow your system. Go back to the priest first. You can even be a witness to him. And then watch what happens in verse 45. "But he went out and began to talk freely about it and to spread the news so that Jesus could no longer openly enter a town, but was out in the desolate places, and people were coming to him from every quarter." So Jesus tells him, don't go speak, and what does he do? He speaks anyway. Why? Because that just happens when Jesus rocks your world a little bit. And we see this throughout the Gospels multiple times, particularly in Mark's Gospel, where Jesus tells people not to tell, often in Jewish territory, where the Jews are still looking for this political Messiah. And he tells them it's not the time, it's not the place. He tells them not to go tell, and still they do, because you just do that when Jesus touches you. And you see the end of this chapter. Remember, we start with the story of John the Baptist. He's in the wilderness saying, "It's not about me. I'm deflecting the glory to Jesus. There's one coming after me who is mightier than I." And look at how this chapter ends. Because of the popularity of Jesus, he's driven out to the desolate places, and the people are now coming to him. So even geographically, we see this transition, that here is John the Baptist in the wilderness and people coming to him. You end the chapter, though, with Jesus now in desolate places and the people coming to him, because the transition has now been made. Let me show you just a couple of other examples. Go with me to chapter 2. Chapter 2, verse 12. Jesus has healed a paralytic. You remember he was lowered through the roof. Jesus forgave his sins and told him, pick up your bed and walk. Verse 12 says this, and he arose and immediately picked up his bed and went out before them all. So that they were all what? They were all amazed and glorified God, saying, we never saw anything like this. I'll show you some other places. Go with me to chapter 5. Chapter 5, the first part of chapter 5, in this particular context, the latter part of Mark 4 and all of chapter 5, here's what we'll learn about Jesus. He is the master over nature. He can calm the sea when the disciples are in the boat. He's the master over demons. He heals this Gadarene demoniac. He's the master over sickness. He heals the woman with the blood disease. And ultimately, he's the master over death as he raises Jairus' daughter. And so we get this picture of this one who is master over all, because he's not just anybody. He is Jesus, the Son of God. But he heals this demoniac. You remember what the demoniac says? He says, I just want to hang out with you. And we'd all want that. When I'm like this demoniac, I'm chained, and I keep breaking the chains, screaming in the night, gashing myself with stones. Nobody can overpower me. And here comes Jesus, and he completely transforms me. I'd want to hang out with Jesus too. But watch what Jesus tells him. Verse 19. And he did not permit him, but said to him, go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you, and how he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began to proclaim to the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him, and everyone marveled. Everyone marveled. Jesus releases him. In fact, he tells him, go back to the Decapolis. Go back into Gentile territory. And go back and tell the story. And he goes back and he tells him, people marvel at the story that they hear. And that's the way it ought to be. It ought to be such that Jesus so changes us and so transforms us that we can't help but tell, and out of our wonder and out of our amazement, we speak about Christ and others begin to marvel as well. That's the way it ought to work. But here's what happens, I think. I think we lose our wonder. I think we lose our amazement. In fact, you look at chapter 6. Remember, Jesus makes his way to Nazareth, and the people are saying, don't we know him? Where did this man get these things? This is the latter part of verse 2. What is the wisdom given to him? How are such mighty works done by his hands? Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Are not his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. And Jesus would say, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown. And verse 6 says, he marveled because of their unbelief. You know what their problem was? He was too ordinary to them. They knew him as a part of this family. Where does he get this wisdom? He's just one of us. And he marvels at their unbelief. He marvels at the fact that they're not amazed at who he is. And I wonder for us if Jesus has become routine. I wonder if he's become the norm for us. Let me show you how that gets fleshed out. Let me give you a formula here. And this is not my formula. This comes from Mark Middleberg and Bill Hybels. But I want to unpack this for you in a way that I hope is helpful. It's a formula that Middleberg devised for doing evangelism, but I want to use this as a launching pad to think about why we need to rethink how we do missions and evangelism. HP plus CP plus CC equals MI. HP stands for high potency. And it means people who are just on fire for God, who are just on fire for Jesus. It means people like this. My father passed away a little over 2 years ago now. I grew up with tough memories of my dad. He drank a lot when I was young. I remember my first memory is of my father just obliterating our house in a drunken stupor. And I remember every detail of that day as if it happened yesterday. It's that strong in my mind. And I could walk you through our house where I grew up and show you places where my dad would throw things at us and it hit the wall. And just in a fit of rage, he would just blow a gasket and then get old. And I had a lot of memories like that. In fact, to be real honest, I grew up pretty much hating my father. I kept a baseball bat in my bedroom right by the door because if he had ever touched my mother, I'd have taken his head off. It's just the world I grew up in. I became a believer age 13, still struggling, didn't know how to love my father. Struggled a long time, to be honest. And it wasn't until God took me to Ephesians 6, where the text says, "We wrestle not against flesh and blood." Those of you who know me know I speak a lot about spiritual warfare. It was that experience in my life that began to make me think about spiritual warfare. I don't wrestle against human beings. My dad's not the enemy. And God began to help me to learn to love my father and pray for my father. Well, 3 years before my dad died, the Lord radically changed him. He called my little brother in Ohio and he said, "You know, we've been talking about this Jesus thing. I need to talk about him now." And my dad went to my brother's house. And my brother said, "I'll tell you what, if you're ready, I'll help you pray." They knelt together. My brother began praying. He said, "My dad just took it from there." And my dad, like a baby, just unfolded his heart before the Lord. And God so changed my dad. Honestly, I get chills thinking about it right now. The last 3 years of his life, we had no idea who he was. He was so changed. And so we bought him his first Bible at age 71, as large a print as we could find because he could barely see from diabetes. And God just dramatically changed him. He didn't live long, 3 years. I'll tell you what, he never got over Jesus. Amen. He never got over Jesus. And I'm the professor of evangelism. Put to shame. HP means you're on fire for Jesus. CP means close proximity. Close proximity. Let me explain close proximity to you. Close proximity means we are intentionally in relationship with non-believers that we can show Christ to them and share Christ with them. Meaning we intentionally know non-believing people. When I teach this in my classroom or I teach this in a local church, we won't do this, but I want you to at least think about this. I have folks write two lists for me. The first list, I ask them to list the names of 10 believers with whom they're close enough they can share a prayer concern with them. So I give them a few minutes. So write down the names of 10 believers. You know them well enough. You could email them today. You could call them today. And you can share a prayer concern with them. And away they go. When I first started teaching, they'd write it on a notepad. Now they're clicking it on their computer and I don't see their face. So the world's changed. But they can write down the 10 names pretty quickly. And then I say, second list is this. I want you to write the names of 10 non-believers, as far as you know, they're non-believers, 10 non-believers with whom you are close enough that you could go home today and share the gospel with them. 10 non-believers with whom you're close enough that you could go home today and share the gospel with them. Well, what do you think happens with that second list? It's tough to, I listen to the clicking of the computer, it doesn't last long. Why? Because we get cocooned in our Christian world. In fact, I argue this, the longer that you are in church and the higher you go up the leadership ladder, the more likely it is you're separated from lost people. So close proximity means, no, I know lost people, and I intentionally know lost people. And for most of us, in order to intentionally know lost people, that means we have to give something else up and figure out how to fit lost people into our lives. Well, listen to that. We're proclaimers of the good news of Jesus Christ, that God came to us and died for us while we were yet sinners. And yet somehow we have to shift our schedules to figure out how to get the lost people? Something's amiss there. So I would challenge all of us to think through, how do we reconnect? And I don't mean we reconnect with people who come to our church first. I mean, how do we get outside of our bubble and get to know lost people? Then the CC is clear communication. Clear communication means the preparation, the training. That I know how to share the gospel. Doesn't necessarily mean I do it, but clear communication means I've been through some training in order to know how to transition a conversation to the gospel and to share the good news of Jesus and call someone to faith and repentance. That's clear communication. You put these together, you take believers who are on fire for God, who know lost people, who know how to share the gospel, and the result is maximum impact. Now, is it formulaic? Yes, but what I like about this is I think it works biblically. That people who are amazed by Jesus get out and tell somebody about Jesus, and God just works through that. Now, you tell me, HP, CP, CC, as Southern Baptists, where are we strongest? Are we strongest at high potency, close proximity, or clear communication? What do you think? Where's our strength? Yeah, I think our strength is right here, clear communication. Now again, it doesn't mean that we've done a good job of training people, but it does mean we've got the tools to do it if we want to. And if we don't like the ones we got, we'll just create another one. We've got the resources. We can get the resources, right? We've got that. We can train people. So I think that probably is our strength. Where's our weakness then, HP or CP? I've heard both. Where's our weakness? Let me challenge you with a question. Can you be HP, that is on fire for God, and not be CP? I don't think so. If you're genuinely on fire for God and genuinely have the heart of God, you'll figure out how to connect with lost people. Because that's the gospel. That's the heart of God. Now, I can envision maybe that person who's raised in church, who only knows church people, who then becomes a believer. I can envision that person struggling for a little bit because the only world he knows is a church world. But if he really grabs the heart of God and he's really amazed by Jesus, the heart of God is initiating the gospel, meaning God came to us. He doesn't wait for us to climb the ladder to him. God came to us. So Jesus, his very coming, his incarnation models that we must go to a dying world. If we really are amazed by God, we'll figure out how to reconnect with lost people. Now, I'll be honest with you. When I tell my students this, they get stressed with me because they're on our seminary campuses. They're going to chapel. They're in their own church. So 3 or 4 times a week, they're worshiping. They're learning original languages. They've never studied like they're studying now. They're reading books. And as far as they know, they're on the mountaintop of their experience with God. And I will argue with them. If your mountaintop means you're only hanging out on this campus and you don't know lost people, you're not on fire for God. You're on fire for learning. You're on fire for education. To be on fire for God means we'll figure out how to get here. And see, here's my concern. We want people to do the Great Commission. We want them to do missions. We want them to do evangelism. And I'm right there. That's very much my heartbeat. I want us doing that. I want us training people how to share the gospel. I want us thinking cross-culturally. How do I speak the gospel to people with a different worldview? How do I connect with them? I want us to know all of this. But my concern is this. We do this with our programs, and I like our programs. I've written some of our programs, so don't hear me say for a second I'm opposed to programs. That's not my point. But what we often see is we start with an agenda and a program, and it works a while, and then it declines a little bit, and we decide the program must not have been very good. And so then we find another one, and it works a while, and then it declines. Well, maybe that wasn't as good. We get another one. And I still like this because you're at least doing something. I'm okay with that. But why do we see these dips? Well, here's part of our problem. We're trying to program people to do missions and evangelism. We're trying to program people who've lost their fire for God and don't know lost people anyway. No program is going to fix that problem. It just can't. And so what I want us to think about is this. When are most believers most on fire for God? When we first become believers. In fact, they may well be highest at HP when they're brand new believers. But you know what? They're probably highest at CP then too. Because they're most connected with a lost world. We're the ones who pull them out of the lost world. In some ways, new believers are more a threat to the enemy than you and I are. Because if it's become routine for us and we don't know lost people anyway, we're not a threat to the enemy. So part of what I think we have to think about is how do we help these young believers who are potent for God, how do we help them keep that fire burning? Because something happens, and we all know it, something happens where that fire begins to get quenched. And we wonder what happens. Well, one of the reasons it happens is because we have nothing in place to keep the fire burning. I was a firefighter when I was in Kentucky, and a volunteer firefighter, and I know that in order for a fire to be burning, there has to be fuel, there has to be oxygen. You got to have something there that's going to burn. And so for me, what that means is we've got this new believer who's on fire for God, and there, that's a fire, that's a flame, who's on fire for God, and here comes the enemy to do everything he can do to put that fire out. And if we don't have something in place, meaning we're not walking beside those new believers, those of us who do still have fire, if we're not building into their lives, if we're not helping them immediately know how to share the gospel, if we're not teaching them immediately how to fight temptation, if we're not continuing to fuel this fire, their fire is going to go out. And here's what we're going to have. We're going to have church members for whom Christianity is routine, which is where we are. And we get frustrated at them, we get angry with them, and we think, why aren't you listening? Why aren't you doing what I'm asking you to do? Why aren't you doing this in the church, and why aren't you doing this in the church? Well, one of the reasons is we've let baby Christians flounder on their own and wonder why the fire went out. So I want to challenge you this morning. First of all, when were you most amazed by Jesus? And I hope it's today. But it may not be. It may be that those of us who lead God's people find that our highest wonder and amazement were in days gone by. And that's problematic. So I want us to ask the hard question, when was I so amazed by Jesus that I couldn't help but tell people about him? And if those were in the yesterdays of our lives, God calls us to repentance. God calls us to wonder again. And then think about, if God chooses to give you new believers in your church, what do you have in place to keep putting the fuel on that fire? What's there? What's there that's effective? And you can say to me, well, we've got Sunday school, we've got preaching, we've got all these things. We've got all these things that are all important, and they're all part of putting the fuel on the fire. But have you seen people keep the fire burning? Have you seen the fire burn out? If you've seen the fire burn out, then something's not right. And I think one of the ways we can start to fix this is for those of us who are leaders to make sure that our fire is burning more brightly than ever, number one. And then number two, find two or three men in your church that you can pour your life into. They're there. They're there. Somewhere. You may have to pray hard to find them. You may have to convince them to walk with you. It may take you longer than you wish. And as you pray, God might direct you to somebody in your church that you wish He hadn't. He might. He might call you to invest your life in somebody who may stab you in the back. Not unlike Jesus calling out His disciples. But I can tell you this. If your fire is burning and you're helping one or two people get their fire reignited, your church can be a stronger Great Commission church tomorrow because of the decision you make today. I think what we do is we think, how do I change my whole church? Don't worry about changing your whole church. Jesus couldn't get His whole group on board. Don't worry about changing your heart. Start changing one or two lives and give them a heart for Jesus. Then help them to see that that means you have to go out and tell people about Jesus, and you have to be heartbroken over the nations, because that's the heart of God. Change one life at a time, and your church will be more Great Commission minded. Jesus, He's not just anybody. He's the Son of God. And He's amazing.